Sai Ram. Starting today, Radio Sai is pleased to bring you an audio version of possibly the most talked about book on Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listeners, welcome to weekly readings from Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author, Mr. Howard Moffat, was among the very early Westerners who came to Sri Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964. And drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the path of love and selfless service that Sri Satya Sai Baba personifies and preaches. The readings will be run every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Mr. Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat, is a very comprehensive coverage of the various miracles Sri Satya Sai Baba has performed to save his devotees from serious illnesses or from the brink of their deaths. But it cannot be classified as a mere chronicle of miracles, for hidden in this book are much deeper learning, insights, answers, and experiences that all of us can benefit from. Before we begin the session with readings from the first chapter, let us learn a little bit about the author, Mr. Howard Moffat. An Australian by nationality, Mr. Moffat was born in 1906 in Tasmania, Australia. He grew up in a family that enjoyed a strong Christian background. Early in life, he became interested in the ancient Indian practice of yoga, and several years after participating in yoga classes, Howard met Iris, his wife-to-be and companion in travels and spiritual seeking. Together they studied and traveled to Europe. After visiting and attending a spiritual practice called Subud for some time in 1964, the couple sailed east to attend the School of Wisdom at the Theosophical Society's Adyar Institute on the river Adyar, at what was then known as the city of Madras. But what makes this book unique is the fact that Mr. Moffat probably was the first from the Western world to come to Satya Sai Baba as a Western skeptic and stay with him or near him for some 6 years. Today, the book that he researched and compiled with dedication and hard work has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer that introduced millions to Sri Satya Sai Baba. It was first published in 1971. This singular documentation of the Sai phenomena and its inexplicable wonders has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the Sai fold. As Mr. Moffat explains, this book is intended to reach three classes of readers. The first includes the men and women to whom the mysterious and miraculous ways of life hold interest. The second includes the spiritual seekers who have not yet found what they seek. And the third, the many devotees of our dear Lord Sai. The unique aspect of this book is Mr. Murfitt's analytical and scientifically detailed approach to the divine. Throughout the course of this book, he offers an unbiased and scientific approach toward the many miracles of Bhagwan. Unlike many of the books that have been written on Bhagwan, this book brings to fore the various evidences, aspects, and interpretations of the great Sai power. The author, however, has a caveat. He suggests that while his approach may come across as being a trifling cold to devotees who are already in the know of the great Sai power, the book is primarily meant to satiate the first two classes of readers. Regarding the topic of miracles, the author says,
"Miracles have been a part and parcel of human lives for ages, from Lord Krishna to Jesus to the many other gods and saints that most religions have come to discover. Miracles have always been the common denominator. Surprisingly, the human mind, which appears to accept these miracles in the form of various fairy tales during childhood, fails to believe the very same fundamentals when they grow up. The failure of human mind to associate with such occult powers and miracles occurs because man is unable to confine them or explain them under the commonly accepted scientific realms. In his exact words, miracles are a phenomenon concerning which we neither understand the causative laws ourselves, nor believe them to be understood by the large body of scientific workers in whom we put our trust and faith."
With such a simple yet profound definition of miracles, Mr. Murfitt marks the beginning of the book. Throughout the course of this book, he reveals his own skepticism to the various miracles performed by Bhagwan Baba, and details the process of how that skepticism transforms itself into complete belief. Recounting his exact thought and experiences of having witnessed the countless miracles performed by our Swami, Mr. Murfitt takes his readers through the fathomless ocean of the many inexplicable miracles that are but a common occurrence in the lives of God's devotees. Chapter 1. This chapter, as well as every single one in this book of 20 chapters, begins with a profound quote from a variety of sources. Chapter 1. The search begins with a quote from an anonymous source which says, quote, "If therefore ye are intent upon wisdom, a lamp will not be wanting." Unquote. Many of us would have discovered Bhagwan's divinity through a mysterious series of events and experiences that perhaps make sense only on retrospection. The realization that our whole life is the playing out of the divine master plan sometimes dawns upon the devotee only when God himself explains it. In chapter 1, we find that Mr. Murfitt's journey to Sai was no different. In his search, however, lies a message for every spiritual aspirant, a message which reveals what divine seekers across religions and faiths must pray for. Here are select excerpts from the first chapter entitled, The Search.
"After spending some time in Europe, my wife and I decided to stop for a while in India on our way back to Australia. We had two purposes in view. One was to go more deeply into Theosophy by attending the 6 months School of the Wisdom at the international headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Adyar, Madras. Our second purpose was to travel through the country to discover if there was any deeper spiritual dimension in the life of modern India. Was therefore, we wondered, anything left of the mysterious India described in the pages of Paul Brunton, Yogananda, Kipling, Madame Blavatsky, Colonel H.S. Olcott, and other writers? Were there still hidden fountains of esoteric knowledge, or had the ancient springs dried up? Would it be possible to find somewhere, in ashram or jungle hermitage, great yogi of supernormal powers who knew the secrets of life and death? Our search took us to several of the well-known ashrams throughout the length of India, and to a few little-known ones. We sat and talked with hermits and ascetics in their caves in the Himalayas.
After the author and his wife had spent considerable time interacting with the hermits and the intellectuals, they found themselves in conversation with the secretary of the Radha Swami group in Dayal Bagh, near the city of Agra in North India. During their discussion on the topic of finding the elusive incarnation, the secretary recalled a question that the late Paul Brunton had posed to his leader, Sahabji Maharaj. In reply, the latter had said, quote, "Pray every day to God that He will lead you to the man in whom He is at present incarnated," unquote. He advised the Murfits to do the same. The author goes on to say,
"It was all very strange. I was not sure that I believed in modern incarnations. Maybe in ancient times, as the scriptures taught, there had been such men like Rama, Krishna, Christ and others. I knew many in India regarded some comparatively modern spiritual teachers such as Paramahamsa Ramakrishna as incarnations or avatars. But I had never hoped or expected to meet one in the 1960s. The idea had not occurred to me. I was all beyond my understanding or hopes. My wife and I decided that if among the teeming millions of India there was an incarnation today, we would love to find him, so the prayer could do no harm."
Chapter 2, entitled Satya Sai Baba, begins with a quote from Lord Byron. Quote, "Truth is always strange, stranger than fiction." Unquote. The entry of divinity in all our lives almost certainly is preceded by a series of events that under normal circumstances may pass off as mere coincidences. In Chapter 2, entitled Satya Sai Baba, we find Mr. Murfit's experience was no different. Let us listen to select excerpts of his first rendezvous with Satya Sai Baba.
"I first heard the name of Satya Sai Baba from a wandering yogi. While the yogi had himself not met Baba, he did tell me that Baba possessed many siddhis and was known to be a great miracle worker. He said that Baba's powers are much greater than the other supernormal feats that some other men have performed, and that he performs them frequently and anyone can see them. This certainly was enough to arouse my interest and curiosity. I realized that meeting Satya Sai would be my great chance to find out if the fantastic tales that come out of India belong to the realm of fact or fiction. And the fact that Satya Sai Baba was believed to be the reincarnation of Shirdi Sai only strengthened my desire to meet him. But since the previous tours spanning the country had already taken a toll on our health, we decided to recoup a little in the Theosophical Society, Madras, before commencing our trip to Puttaparthi.
But as luck would have it, through a fellow resident in the society, Nirmalananda, they heard that Swami also happened to be in Madras at that time. Nirmalananda was among the lucky few whom Bhagwan had brought with him to the city. The ways of the divine are indeed mysterious. Every piece falls in place when the Lord Himself decides to bestow blessings on His devotees. The next day, Mr. Murfit found himself at a devotee's house in Madras, where Bhagwan was then residing. He was made to wait in a small sitting room along with two Indian men. Of that impending moment that would define his life forever, he says.
After a few minutes, the door from the interior of the house opened, and there entered a man the like of whom I have never seen before nor since. He was slight and short. He wore a red silk robe that fell in a straight line from shoulders to feet. His hair stood up from his head in a big circular mop, jet black, crinkly to the roots like wool, and seemingly vibrant with life. His skin was light brown, but seemed darker because of the thick beard, which, though closely shaven, still showed black through the skin. His eyes were dark, soft, and luminous, and his face beamed with some inner joy. I had never seen a photograph of Sai Baba. Could this be he? I had expected someone tall and stately, with a long black beard and dressed in white robes. I had a preconceived image of what a great yogi or master should be like, perhaps derived from early theosophical descriptions of the masters. He came swiftly and gracefully across the carpet towards me, showing white, even teeth in a friendly smile. "Are you the man from Australia?" he asked. "Yes," I replied. Then he went to the Indians and began talking to them in Telugu. Presently, I saw him wave his hand in the air, palm downwards, in small circles, just as in childhood we used to wave our hands when pretending to perform some abracadabra magic. When he turned the palm up, it was full of fluffy ash, and he divided this among the two men. One of them could not contain his feelings. He began to sob. Sai Baba patted him on the shoulders and back, and spoke to him soothingly like a mother. I did not understand at the time that these were what are called bhakti tears, tears of overwhelming joy, gratitude, and love. After a while, the small figure turned to me again. Standing close in front of me, he began circling his hand again. This time, I noticed he pulled his loose-fitting sleeve almost up to the elbow. Much later, I learned the reason for this. In my mind was the suspicion that he might be doing conjuring tricks like a stage magician, perhaps bringing the ash out of his sleeve. Baba has no difficulty in reading minds and knew my suspicions. So he pulled his sleeve high to allay them. When the mound of powdery ash appeared suddenly in his palm, he tipped it into mine. For a moment I stood there wondering what to do with it. Then a fellow devotee to my left said, "Eat it. It's good for your health." I had never expected to eat ash and enjoy it, but this brand was fragrant and quite pleasant to the taste. Baba stood there watching me. Halfway through the strange snack, I said to him, "May I take some of this to my wife? She's not very well." "Bring her here tomorrow at 5 o'clock, he replied, and then he was gone. The next afternoon found Iris and myself at the same house. In the entrance, we met Gabriella Steyer of Switzerland, one of the small Western contingent in Baba's traveling party. We sat down near them, and Gabriella began to tell us about some of the miracles she had seen at Puttaparthi. Taking out my notebook, I asked her for the full address of the ashram and directions on how to get there. But at that moment, I was told that Baba was on his way and that I should go and sit on the other side of the room, the men's proper territory. From the doorway, Baba pointed his finger at me and said, "Did you bring your wife?" I was pleased that he had remembered. He took us both into another room and talked to Iris about her health. He seemed to know just what was wrong with her and the basic causes of the trouble. He gave her much advice and then, with his hand wave, produced from the air some medicinal ash for her to eat. I was standing close by, keenly watching the production, because I still doubted that it was genuine magic. Now he turned to me, smiled, pulled up his sleeve up to his elbow, and waved his hand under my nose. As he turned the palm up, I expected to see the usual ash, but I was wrong. Lying in the middle of his hand was a little photograph of his head with the full address of the ashram. The photo had a freshly glazed look, as if straight from a photographic laboratory. He handed it to me, saying, "You've been asking for my address? Here it is. Keep it in your wallet." May we come there sometime?" I managed to ask. "Yes, of course. Whenever you wish. It's your home."
That was the end of their first interview with Swami. However, Swami's act of producing vibhuti made Mr. Murfitt wonder if Satya Sai truly was the reincarnation of Shirdi Sai. Listen carefully as Mr. Murfitt explains the significance of ash.
"The constant production of ash, or vibhuti as it is called, seemed to have a special significance. It made me think of Sai Baba of Shirdi and the fire he always kept burning to produce the udi, which he gave to his followers for curing their ailments and for other purposes. Now it was as if Satya Sai, who perhaps really was his incarnation, could produce this ash from a fire that burned in a dimension beyond the range of our mortal eyes. Ash is a spiritual symbol and has been used as such by many religions, including the Christian. Like all symbols, it has different levels of meaning. An obvious one is that it reminds us of the transitory nature of all earthly things and the mortality of man's body. It is meant to lead our thoughts to the eternal beyond the transitory, to our own immortal selves beyond the little mound of ash or dust to which our bodies will someday be reduced. For the Hindus, ash is especially sacred to the god Shiva, or that aspect of the Godhead concerned with the destruction of all material forms. Destruction is considered a divine attribute because only through destruction can there be a regeneration, a rebirth of new forms through which life can flow more freely, more fully, more vitally."
Mind is indeed a mad monkey. Despite having witnessed the few inexplicable miracles by Swami, Mr. Murfitt did not completely buy it all. There was a conflict between his rational and spiritual self. But he did accept that Swami had left a mark on them, a deep-seated impression that made them want more.
During the next few days, we talked a good deal about a strange experience. Apart from his miraculous abilities, Sai Baba had a powerful effect. He seemed to lift us up to some high level where there were no more worries. We became larger than life, and the usual difficulties and conflicts of the mundane world were far off, unreal. There seemed to be an aura of happiness around us. Iris mentioned that she could not stop herself smiling for hours after Baba had talked to her. As for the miracles themselves, well, as time went on, I began to ask myself if I had really seen them. It all seemed so unlikely, so far, outside the commonplace everyday order of things. It is very difficult for the mind, trained in logic and the physical sciences and believing implicitly in the rational order of the universe, to accept the reality of such apparently irrational phenomena. Even after seeing such miracles, it is difficult to believe in them. So a doubt hung in my mind like a morning mist. Was I, after all, fooled? Was it, after all, just a clever sleight of hand? Going over the facts and conditions carefully, I failed to see how this could be so. Ash would be a difficult, if not impossible, thing to hold in the palm of a hand, waving in circles, wide open and turned downwards. And how could he bring it out of a pocket or a sleeve, even if he had pockets? Which he did not. And even if the cuffless sleeve was down to the wrist rather than pulled up nearly to the elbow as it often was. But perhaps there was some way in which he could have done the things I saw by brilliant conjuring. Perhaps his apparent mind reading and his inside knowledge of one's personal problems were no more than clever guessing.
While inwardly, Mr. Murfitt did feel the elevating splendor of Swami's presence, which spoke volumes about Swami not being any imposter, he could not be absolutely sure. He was not certain that he had indeed met a man of truly supernormal powers, and that he had witnessed genuine miracles. He needed to investigate further. He reckoned that he would have to observe such phenomena many times under many different circumstances and conditions. And for this, he would have to get to know the miracle man himself, learn his character, his background, his life, and the kind of people who followed him. He decided to visit that ashram in Puttaparthi. With that, we come to the end of today's presentation. We hope you will join us in this reading book session every week. Meanwhile, all the best and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.